EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merge 1095. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
County dispatch. Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls.
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Hello everyone and welcome to the show, wherever in the world you are listening from. Tonight we are joined by the wonderful Debbie Carbel from Indiana. Debbie was the central figure in Bud Hopkins' classic book Intruders, The Incredible Visitations at Copley Woods, as well as its 1992 TV miniseries Intruders. Bud gave Debbie the pseudonym Kathy Davis to protect her and her family. She is also the author of Extraordinary Contact, Life Beyond Intruders. Debbie up next. But first, if you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the show, Deb.
Thank you. I am happy to be here.
And thank you for coming on the podcast. It is wonderful to have you join us. And you're calling from Erie, Indiana.
Erie, Kokomo, Indiana.
There used to be a TV show back in the mid-90s, and that was called Erie, Indiana.
Uh-huh. I remember that, yeah.
I love that show. Now, your experiences kind of began in 1983, but our listeners may know you as Kathy Davis, because Bud Hopkins used that name as a pseudonym when he based his book Intruders on you.
That's correct.
Would you like to take us back to the very beginning, please, Deb?
Sure. The book Intruders is kind of centered around an event that happened to me in 1983. But I had unusual experiences that went back before that in the 70s and in the 60s, beginning about the time I was 6, I think. But I'll start at the June 30th, 1983 incident, because that was the focal point of Intruders. That is the turning point for my life. And that's what most people recognize. I was living with my mom and dad at the time. I was a single mother. I had 2 little kids that were not even in kindergarten yet. And I was cutting patterns out for a seamstress friend of mine that lived behind us. So that night I was going to go cut some patterns and make a little extra money to help out. And we had just finished our supper and I was standing at the kitchen sink washing my hands. And I looked out the window at the sink and I noticed a light in the pump house of my mom and dad's swimming pool. The pump house was north of the swimming pool, right at the end of it. And I knew that light shouldn't have been there because I had gone out earlier in the afternoon and dosed the pool with chlorine. I did chores around the house for them. I mentioned it to my mom that the light was on out there, and she's like, well, don't worry about it. Your dad will turn it off when he comes home. Something about the light didn't quite set right with me at the moment, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Thinking back later, I realized that the light wasn't quite the right color. It was brighter and a whiter kind of light than would typically be in there. I didn't fully consciously realize that at the time. Well, the house is a tri-level sandstone, and there was a double driveway. When you pulled in off the street, you could take one drive down to the front of the two-car attached garage, or you could split the drive and go down the side of the house along the swimming pool and back to a turnaround that was in front of a workshop that my father had built back there where he worked on his models and stuff. So I thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to drive down that side road, that side drive, and just take a quick look before I leave, just to make sure I don't see anybody out there, because I'm about to leave my mom and my two little kids here. And I'm not thinking aliens, UFOs, or any other kind of weird stuff at that time. I'm concerned about a prowler or, you know, somebody that's going to break in the house. So I go along the drive, round the turnaround and back, and I noticed that the light was out, which I thought, well, I guess the light bulb burned out. But I did also notice that the pedestrian door to the garage was now open, and I knew that was not supposed to be open. So I kind of figured the dog that was in the garage was out somewhere now. But I didn't stop. I went ahead and went on over to my friend's house. She just lived one street behind us, so it took literally 2 minutes to get to her house. And then when I got there, I called my mom, and I told her, the light's out, but the door to the garage is open. So that means Penny's loose. And she said, well, don't worry about it. I'll just lock the doors, and when your dad gets home, he can worry about it. And I'm like, okay. So I hung the phone up, and as soon as I hung it up, it rang again. And I just, like, instinctively just snatched it right back up. And I answered it, and it was my mom. And she said, Debbie, I want you to come home right now. And she sounded weird, completely out of character for my mom, because my mom never got ruffled feathers or scared over anything. And she sounded scared. So I got disturbed, and I'm like, what's wrong? Why? What's going on? And my friend and her husband heard me, and he hollers over my shoulder, hey, tell her to call the police. That's what we pay them for. And she heard him, and she said, no, I don't want anyone here but you. And I'm like, okay. So I told my friends, I'll be back in a little bit. I'm going to go see what's going on here. And I went on back over to the house, pulled up that side driveway again, and I parked my car. And I got out of the car and went into the little patio room that was at the edge of the driveway and met my mom in there. And I grabbed the shotgun that my father had, he kept stowed behind the trash compactor out there. It was not loaded because I had asked him to keep it not loaded while my kids and I lived there because it made me nervous. So it wasn't loaded. And my mom reminded me, she says, you know, that's not loaded, right? And I said, yeah, well, whoever I hit upside the head with it isn't going to realize it's not loaded till I get close enough to them to hit them. So, and then I always tell people it's this point here where I'm going out here being all brave and everything that is absolutely out of character for me at that time in my life. I was the least brave person I know back then. Now I would do it in a hot minute, but back then, no. So I go out, walk around the yard, see if I can see anything. I check the pump house out, and I don't see anything. I walk back behind the swimming pool and by my dad's ladder truck, and I found my dog under the ladder truck, but I couldn't get her to come out. And I'm like, so whatever, stay. And I go back across the yard, and I go into the garage that's attached to the house. I go through that open pedestrian door, and I figure if somebody's there, they're going to be in that garage. And I flipped the light on and I looked around and nobody was there. And just about as I was about to look behind a mattress and I realized there was no one there behind this mattress, I felt like I was on fire. It felt like every molecule of my body started to burn. My skin felt like it was on fire. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I got to get out of here now. And I turned to run through the pedestrian door was open. And as I hit the open doorway, something hit me in the chest. And it felt like I got hit by lightning is what was in my head. It was a bright light. I know my eyes were shut, but I could still see it, and it hurt. And I could feel every molecule of my body felt like it was vibrating individually. And this sensation was spreading. It hit me in like the solar plexus, and it started spreading down my legs and my arms and up my around my head, and I couldn't move. And time felt like it stopped. I just felt like I was coming apart at the molecular level, and time just ceased for this moment. So, and I don't know how long this lasted, because I don't know how long that I was in that state. I feel like I couldn't have survived if I'd been too long, but suddenly the light intensity got lots less. The vibrating started to stop, and I started feeling connected again. And at this point, I'm a little bit outside the doorway on this patio, and I can move my eyes, although my vision is totally fried. And the only way I could describe it is like if you've gotten your picture taken with one of those old flash cubes and you didn't get to blink, then you can't see anything for a while because your vision is this white blast on everything. But I could see movement in front of me. I could see enough to see what I thought were kids in my parents' backyard. And I'm thinking to myself, why are these kids in the backyard? And they were coming from like all directions in the backyard, and they were lining up in front of me off to my left. And then they started to kind of slide, kind of glide down towards me, but not at me, just in front of me. And it was more, wasn't a walk. It was more like a glide. It was the weirdest thing. And I thought, when I drew pictures of them for Bud, I drew more bullet shaped because I thought they kind of looked bullet shaped because their heads were bigger than their little arms and feet, you know, so they were like little kids with big heads. And at one point during this whole memory, I remember somebody pulling down on my shoulders. And then I remember something going in my right ear that felt like a knitting needle on fire. And I have no idea what that was for, but I couldn't even scream. I couldn't fight. And I heard someone say it was unfortunate that I had felt the pain. You know, in retrospect, I feel like whatever damage was done to my eyes or me or my dog or any pain I had or any fear I had, I don't believe it was intentional. I think it was inadvertent side effect of whatever was going on. But and then at one point I noticed as these little kids were gliding down in front of me, then a little bit off to my left is when I saw the thing. Now, it's been called a craft for 38 years because for lack of a better way to describe it. But what it actually is, I don't know. Because if I can see those six little kids in there, they're all mashed up against each other and they're not flying 2,000 light years away anywhere in that little thing. So I don't know what that was. It was shaped like an egg. It had a white soft ball of light out in front of it about the size of a basketball, and it was about as high up off the ground as I am tall, and I'm 5'3". It went down real slow, and then it came back up real slow, and I kept thinking to myself, is that thing moving? You know, I didn't want to look at it, but I didn't not want to look at it because I wanted to see if it was going to come near me because I was going to lose my mind. And I felt like it was moving ever so slightly, like a bobber on clear, smooth water. And it had four appendages coming out the middle of it, one on each side, you know, like fours. But they were too skinny for me. I thought they looked too skinny to be weight bearing. I felt more it was like stabilization, you know, and I saw two of them, and I kind of thought I could see the parts of two more, but you know, my vision wasn't that clear. At one point, I remember thinking, oh my God, my kids. And immediately after I had that thought, I heard the voice again. I never saw anybody talk to me consciously, say, your kids are fine, you know. And then sometime after that, I heard my name. And when I heard my name being called, it was as if someone snapped their fingers and everything that I just described to you went away. My conscious memory was wiped, and I turned and I could move, and I'm walking up. I walk towards the upper patio, and my mom is in the doorway of the kitchen. And I later, she told me it was her that had called my name. And she asked me, is everything okay? And I said, yeah, everything's cool. But in my mind at that point, I'm like, I feel weird. I feel gross. I feel like I want to get wet. You know, I don't know why I want to get wet. So I decided I went back to my friend's house because we determined there wasn't any prowlers there. I went back over to her house and I said, hey, instead of sewing, how about we go for a evening swim? She's like, oh yeah, that'll work. Nothing was ever said about how long I was gone or what happened. Nothing was said about that. And then years later, when a year or so later, when Bud came and started the investigation and he spoke to them, they were even kind of surprised at their own reaction that they would have normally been concerned, because we figured I was probably, from the time I left their house to go back and check on mom and then got back to the house, it was about an hour and 15 minutes or so. But obviously what I've just told you didn't last an hour and 15 minutes. I don't think, I don't know for sure. But so anyway, we go back to the house and she brings her daughter with her, young daughter, teenage-ish, preteen. And as we're walking across the yard, her daughter's complains that something made her foot tingle and burn, and her foot felt like it was getting numb in her leg. And we thought maybe she'd stepped on a bee, but we didn't see anything on her foot. So we're in the pool, maybe 10 minutes or so, and we're all starting to feel kind of nauseous. And my vision is starting to get really funky, and my eyes are starting to burn. And I'm noticing that I see white halos around all the lights. And I'm thinking, what is the deal, you know? And my friend pops off to me. She's like, hey, let's go to White Castle and get some hamburgers. Maybe we'll feel better if we get something to eat. And being in the UK, I don't know y'all know what a White Castle is, but I promise you that a White Castle will not make your stomach feel better. And I don't know what we were thinking, but we decided to head off to the White Castle. They are open 24 hours. But that trip got aborted. I don't know. I can't remember what happened, but somehow we decided that might not be a good idea. So they went ahead and went on home, and I went on home. And when I woke up the next morning, my eyes hurt so bad and were swollen so shut that I could not see. I could not get them open, even with cold water rags, couldn't get them open. So my mom took me to the hospital emergency room. There was a doctor in the emergency room that so happened to be an ophthalmologist, an actual eye doctor. And he had an office across the street. I don't even know why he was in the emergency room, to be honest with you. But he said to my mom, look, I can't examine her the way I need to here, but if you can bring her across the street, I'll call them over there and have them work her in, and I'll have a look at her. I can see her better over there. So they did. And the first thing he said to me when he started the examination was, have you looked into the arc of a welder's torch? And I said, well, no. Why would I do that? That's dumb. You know, I was shocked that he'd asked me that. And obviously I did not tell him what had happened to me the night before, because at that point I still didn't have any conscious memory of it. That didn't come back for a couple of days. So I got eye drops and I got gooey creams for my eyes. And it took a good couple of weeks for my eyes to heal up. And I do remember him mentioning something about how he was surprised, as bad as my eyes were, that they didn't hurt me before this morning. And I'm like, nope, yesterday I was fine. So after that night, in the following days, I started having really strange feelings. I started feeling very paranoid. I started being afraid to go in the bathroom upstairs with the window that overlooked the area where the mark showed up, because I kept feeling like something was going to pull me out the window, which I thought was insane and made no sense. I started to be worried about my kids, and I would sit in their bedroom on a chair, or sometimes I'd lay on a blanket on the floor between their twin beds, and I would be in there all night long, wide awake. And as soon as the sun came up and mom would get up, then I would fall asleep for a little bit. I wasn't sleeping good. I wasn't able to eat well. I started having irregular heartbeats, you know, and I think I was hyperventilating, and I was having this like one long anxiety attack. Oh, but still not really putting two and two together at that point. So the 4th of July weekend comes up quickly. Obviously, apparently, mom, dad, and I had none really looked out the window or looked in the yard much until the family came for that holiday weekend for a cookout and swimming and lighting off copious amounts of Kmart-bought fireworks to annoy all our neighbors. And all the kids went running out with their bath towels and turned around and ran back in. My oldest nephew's like, Grandma, what's wrong with your yard? And so all of us adults got up and went out there, and we're looking around, and there's this mark in the yard. It's an 8-foot circle, roughly, has a 49-foot streak coming off one edge of it that goes all the way across the yard, ends in a perfect arc, and that's about 2 feet wide. And my mother, for whatever reason, pops off with, oh, that's where our UFO landed the other night. And I looked at her and I thought, what? Why did you say that? Where did that come from? I mean, and then I looked back at the mark in the yard, and man, it was like somebody dropped a boatload of bricks on me. And everything started coming back. Everything started trickling back about that night. The blast of light that hit me in the chest, you know, everything started trickling back. I remember looking at that mark, and I see these two big black eyes, like just kind of superimposed over it somewhere in my mind between my head and the yard. You know, I could just see that. And I just really got freaked out. Didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell anybody at that point what I was starting to remember and how I was feeling. I think it might have been kind of obvious to my mom, but she really didn't say a lot to me. She just kind of helped me. God love her. God bless my parents. And it's a good thing I was there with them when this happened, because they really helped me through the early parts of this. And, you know, I started getting sick. I started running fevers and getting, my glands would swell up, and I'd, you know, have tummy problems. The dog that had been out there that night, her hair started falling off, and we thought she had the mange at first, but then it started coming off in spots where she couldn't rub it off. And then she started getting these big black sores all over her back. And then her teeth started falling out in the food bowl, and her eyes whited over. Clearly she couldn't see, and she'd run into the walls and stuff. And by that fall, we had to have her put to sleep. Don't know what happened to her, but the vet said she was suffering, and that's all we needed to know. So I always wondered in the back of my mind if what had happened to her. She was out there that night. What happened to her would be my fate someday. That always stuck in the back of my mind. And as it turns out, my eyes have been a wreck. By the time I was in my 30s, I was diagnosed with cataracts and dry macular degeneration, which is stable now, but I have since had to have surgery to replace my lenses because they were shot. And I will always blame that night, even though I have no proof and can't, you know, for all the skeptics out there, I can't prove it, but you know, I'm the only one in my family that ever had those problems, except my older sister, who had wet macular degeneration and in her 60s, but she also had a UFO experience in 1965. So got to factor that in too. So anyway, I had picked up the book Missing Time, written by Bud Hopkins, months before this happened. I was starting to remember things that happened to me back in the 70s that I couldn't believe that I had forgotten. And things when I was a little kid started to come back. And, you know, then there was the whole thing with my sister in 65 in the church parking lot, where she claimed for years, insisted that a UFO picked her whole car up with her in it and took off with her, and that she was gone for hours. She had dropped my mom off at a bingo game, and then as she was driving by the church, she suddenly felt compelled to pull in the parking lot and drive behind the church. When she did, there was this disc right at treetop level. Her car was right under it. She says that her whole car was lifted up into this thing, and the next thing she remembered was waking up in her car, and it was now dark, and not only that, it was now time to pick my mom up. And so she told us the story for years, and, you know, us younger kids, we believed her. She had no reason to make up something like that, but we would pester her about it until she'd get annoyed and then wouldn't talk anymore. So I went back to the library. I got Missing Time, brought it home, didn't even try to read it because I knew better. Because prior to that, every time I tried to read it, I ended up in the emergency room with a panic attack, thinking I was having a heart attack. I just wanted the address in the back. And I wrote a 14-page letter to Bud, and I included a bunch of Polaroids in the backyard. I started the letter with my sister's 1965 experience, which I didn't ask her permission. So she was pretty mad at me when she found out I did that. And I just said, well, you'll get over it. But And she did. But then I said, oh, by the way, this happened 30th of June. And I wrote him all this I just told you. And my mom, I gave her the letter, and she said to Bud, you know, when she handed me that letter, there was something in me that said, I don't really want to open this can of worms. And she said, I fully intended to not mail that letter. And I carried it around my purse for a week or two. And then she said, I was at a mailbox one day and something said, hey, you need to mail that letter. She's counting on you to mail this letter. She said, so I pulled it out and I dropped it in the mailbox. And she says, and I thought to myself, I hope he never gets it. But a few weeks later, it was a little while later, several weeks passed, and I had gone out with some friends. And when I came home, my mom was laying on the couch and she said, hey, that guy that you wrote that letter to that wrote that book, she called it that book, called. And I'm like, what? She's like, yep, called. She goes, his phone number's over there on the phone thing. I'm like, oh my God. And I remember when I picked up his phone number, I started shaking. And my hands were shaking so hard when I dialed his number, I could barely dial the number. And when he answered the phone, it took me a minute to get my breath to speak. And I felt my face hot and flushed. And that was it. From that point on, it was a 3-year-long investigation. I went to New York a couple times. He came out to Indiana several times. He interviewed our neighbors. He found more witnesses to that night in a couple of neighbors. The lady that lived next to us and then the one across the street from us. The lady who lived directly next to us that night, she said that she saw a bright flash from the backyard and the whole house shook and she got terrified. Her television screen turned red, whatever. I don't know what that means. And her husband told Bud when he came home from work, she was hiding behind the sofa and she was terrified that some men were going to come in and get her. And we didn't even really know these neighbors at that point very well. We didn't really talk, you know. And then the lady across the street from us was a night shift nurse at the hospital I was born at. And so she was just preparing to get about time to get up and start getting ready to go to work. And she said she was waking early because it sounded like a jet airplane was about to crash into her house and her whole house was shaking and her lights were acting weird. And the strangest thing of all was that she reported that all the clocks in the front of her house stopped. The clocks in the back of the house continued to run. Who knows what that was? And, you know, these people were interviewed, didn't know. You know, this was very early. There wasn't, nobody knew unless they witnessed it. And even 20 years later, after Intruders was written, he got a letter from a woman who lived the street behind us. And the houses were separated by a small little bit of wooded area. And this woman says, I can't tell you if it was the exact date, but it was around the same time. My boys were having a sleepover with their friends, and they always slept out in the garage. And the opening of the garage faced the wooded area, which would face the back of Mom's house. And she said they all came screaming in one night, freaked out because they swore up and down there were dozens of basketball-sized balls of white light drifting through the woods. And it scared them because they thought they were coming to get them. And this was 20 years after Intruders was written, and this woman finally stumbled upon it and thought, hey, wait a minute, and wrote to Bud. And it, far the basketball-sized ball of light, it was weeks later, my mom was at the kitchen one day, and she says, oh, you know, I just remembered why I called you home that night. And I'm like, really? Why? What happened? She said, well, I was standing at the kitchen sink looking out the window at the bird feeder. And she said, and there was like a basketball sized ball of white light around the bird feeder. And she goes, at first I thought, well, is somebody there with a flashlight, you know, and is that like just being illuminated by a flashlight? She said, but I didn't see any beam or anyone. And she said, then I thought, well, maybe your dad came home early and he was driving up the side drive. Maybe it was a headlight or something, but didn't see anything like that either. And it continued to stay there. And she says that it got smaller and smaller and smaller. And then poof, it disappeared. And she said, as soon as it disappeared, that's when it come into my head that I needed to call you right back and tell you to come home right now. I'm like, okay. I'm like, thanks for telling me that now. It kind of freaked me out a little bit, but you know, it is what it is. So I sold my washer and dryer to go to New York the first time to see Bud. And as soon as I stepped off the bus, He took me right to a psychiatrist's office, Dr. Aphrodite Clamart, who interviewed me and I'm sure was checking me out, you know, psychologically. And she did hypnotize me. She just to show me what hypnosis felt like. We didn't try digging into anything. And mainly just wanted to try to help me relax a little bit because I had this preconceived notion about hypnosis and I didn't want to, you know, be naked in the middle of Times Square dancing around like a chicken, barking like a dog, you know. And she's like, that's not how it works. So, but, you know, so, I mean, that's how Intruders was born. And, you know, the investigation went on for 3 years and he finally convinced us to let him write a book about it because we didn't want a book. At first, I just wanted to help. That's how desperate I was. I went to New York City. I sold the only thing I had that was worth money to get a bus ticket. And I went to New York City to see a man who I'd never known or never met, who wrote some weird book about aliens and abductions and UFO stuff. And so I'm thinking all this when I'm on the bus and I have this major panic attack and I almost make them pull the bus over and let me get out because I'm thinking, what is wrong with you? You're a mother and this guy could be an axe murderer. Are you insane? You know, and that's just how desperate I was for help at this point. And see, I told you it's a long story. And that's just the one, that's the big thing. But there are a million little things that, like I said, I started having spontaneously remembering things from my childhood, things from when I was a young married, you know, and in the meantime, had an out-of-body experience when I was like 5. Then I had a near-death experience giving birth to my first son, and all the paranormal weirdness was happening, and it really ramped up after 83. And then we had another sighting, mother and I, at the house in April of 84 that was stunning and ended up, I called the Center for UFO Studies hotline in Chicago at like 11 o'clock at night, and J. Allen Hynek himself answered the phone, and we ended up drew a picture for him. We drew independent pictures. He interviewed both of us independently. And he even told my mom, he said, you know what? I'm beginning to think that maybe not everyone can see these things. And he didn't mean that in that, you know, not everybody sees these because not everybody's crazy. In that, I think he meant not everybody's wired to be able to see this stuff. So because we couldn't figure it out. This thing that flew over the house that night on, I believe it was like April 24th, 1984, somewhere around in there, this thing was absolutely humongous. It filled up the entire sky around the trees above the house, the clearing. When I first saw it, as I was coming home from the drugstore, I saw it as a couple of, like two headlights. And I thought, oh, it looks like landing lights from Indianapolis International. Because we only lived like 10 minutes from downtown Indy. So it ain't like we lived in a little, there are millions of people live in Indianapolis. It's a fairly good sized city. But then when the headlight turned into one big one, I'm like, I don't think they do that. You know, I started getting a little freaked out. And as this thing got closer, it wasn't making any noise that I could hear at that point. I hurried it up home and ran in the front door and screamed at my mom to get out on the porch. She's going to see something magnificent in, you know, hurry up and get out here. And she came out with me. And just as she got out there, the thing was directly over us, over our house, over the clearing in the front yard. And it had to be, oh my God. I want to say like 4 or 5 times bigger than the biggest jet. And it was just above treetops. And it looked like a boomerang kind of shape, you know? And when it got directly over us, the lights on the bottom of it turned on and you could literally hear them come on. It was like boom, you know? And you could kind of hear a very, very low frequency vibrational hum-like thing. You could almost feel it. But other than that, it was dead silent. And this thing was huge. And these lights came on. And they were like big strips of fluorescent lights, looking fluorescent-like looking strips. And then all kinds of little dots of lights, like starry dots all over that, you know, not in any particular pattern. And there was like a little ring of small lights in the little tiny, I saw a little tiny red light in the center of that ring. I don't know whether mom saw that or not. I can't remember. But my mom is standing there going, oh my God, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I'm thinking, oh hell no. And I looked at her like, are you insane? And I remember saying out loud, oh my God, not again. And as soon as this thing got over the house, I ran in the front door, through the house and out the back kitchen door, just as this was passing over the house. And you could see it in the backyard, over the backyard, just above treetop level. My dad had a 100-foot ham radio tower in the backyard, and this thing was just above that. So that's how low it was. It got a little bit higher, and I could see it over the treetops. And I see that it went somewhere around the area of 465 and Shayland. And then I couldn't believe what I saw next, because it didn't make any kind of a banking turn or anything. It just swiveled on its axis, like just boots, and started going in a totally different direction. It started coming back towards us, only farther north of us. And I'm thinking, holy crap, this is going to be all over the news. My mom is like turning on the TV because this is going to be on the news. We're going to hear it, turn on the radio. It's going to be somebody going to report this on the radio. It'll be in the paper. Nothing, not a word. Like I said, I called Dr. Hynek at 11 o'clock that night. I called the Center for UFO Studies hotline, and he answered. And we were just flabbergasted that nobody else reported this. Now, that doesn't mean that nobody else saw it. Somebody else had to see it, but nobody was talking. You know, and you got to remember, this was 30 years ago. The attitude about this whole phenomenon has shifted dramatically from 30 years ago to where it is now. You know, it's got a long way to go, but it's way better and way more open than it used to be. So, things continue on. And that's my whole life has just been crazy like this.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
Now, when the object landed in the back garden back in June of 1983 and it left marks in the backyard.
Yes, it did. And that mark stayed there for years, and snow melted off of it. The first year that it was down there, and when we'd get a snow in the wintertime, half an hour later, the snow that was on the actual mark would be gone, and you could see the mark like a snow crop circle. It was insane.
And was there any strange growth with the grass or any flowers in the area?
That I told you there was a small wooded area that separated that the neighbor who saw the bright flash in our house, and that wasn't too very far away from where this thing came down, and appeared, whatever it did. I don't know how it got there, but there was a swath of trees in that area, several feet wide. I'm not maybe 5 or 6 feet wide, something like that. On the leaves on that part turned yellow and wilted much quicker than the rest of the trees did in the fall. And they fell off a lot faster. And then we had some tomato plants planted by the driveway, by where the swimming pool is, near where the arc, the end of the streak was. And those tomato plants grew humongous. The vines on them were like almost size of my wrists. And the tomatoes were like grapefruits. They were huge, but they weren't very good to eat. They didn't have the good flavor, and they were kind of acidic. And then there is even a picture on the website of the dandelion, which is I apologize. First of all, I used a Polaroid, which Polaroids don't last 38 years. It's kind of fadey and janky looking. But the dandelions that grew closer to the area, as opposed to the dandelions out farther in the yard, you could see that they were three times the size. Their little heads, the little yellow heads, and the stems were double the length. And I have a big dandelion, a little dandelion, and an ink pen for perspective, and tried to take a picture of it because they were all huge. It was weird looking. And the coax cable that ran from my dad's ham radio tower into the house melted. And the transformer for the power lines blew, I think, a few days later. And some of the lines in that were melted. I had called the agricultural agent for the state of Indiana. I'd called the gas company. I called the power company. I called whoever I could think to call to try to find out what would cause this. And the grass in the mark wasn't crushed or smooshed. It just looked like it just laid down. And it was kind of a grayish beige color. It was just dead, you know. And the dirt itself was rock hard. Water, it repelled water. I took a chunk of it. I managed to get a chunk up, and I put it in a glass. For 24 hours, I left it all night long, and when I came back, it was still a chunk. Everything else I tried from everywhere else in the yard, when I put it in the water the next day when I got up, I had a glass of muddy water, but not with this stuff. And it smelled kind of weird. It had just a slight kind of a match smell to it, kind of a twangy dead smell. And there was a crack on one side of this circle, like something might have pushed up against it at one point. There was a big crack there. So I had a 12-inch ruler from school, kid school, and I took it and I thought, well, let's see how deep this crack goes. And I actually dropped it accidentally and it disappeared. I never got it back. So it was well over 12 inches deep, the crack where the ground just couldn't take it and just split open. And later on, Bud did have the soil samples tested. He took some back to New York with him. And I think I remember it correctly. It said that it had to be baked at 800 degrees for 12 hours or 1200 degrees for 8 hours. I can't remember which, to get it to even be remotely as dehydrated as it was. And there wasn't any life in this soil. There's like was no bacteria or anything. And I did note that the animals in the yard, like the squirrels and the birds and stuff, never would go on that mark. They walk around it. Even our dog would walk around it as opposed to go across it. When she crossed the yard, she would walk all the way around this thing and get to the other side, which I don't know what all that means. Also, my father and my uncle had a Geiger counter. I don't know where these guys got this. It was out in my dad's workshop. My dad and my uncle both was a little bit of a pack rat, and they had all kinds of toys back there. And it looked real old and funky, but they swore up and down it worked. And they said that they could get it zeroed in the workshop and just fine. But when they got to right about the swimming pool, they didn't have to get right up on top of it. But when they got about to the swimming pool, they weren't able to get it zeroed. I don't know what that means, but I just report to you what they said. Now, I don't know how long it remained like that, you know, and like I said, Bud, it was weeks and weeks before Bud got out there. I did send him, you know, I was like 100 pounds heavier than I am now. And I was out there with a spade, literally jumping on the spade, trying to get some samples up. And I was just barely testing it. I did get some chunks out, but interestingly enough, even though I was in a tornado in 2013 where I literally lost everything that I owned, a few things survived. The little stuff I can't replace survived. And one of those things was some bags that I still have with the soil samples that I took from the mark in the yard, because I took a bunch of them when I could chunk it up. So I still have some. If anybody wants to do any more tests on them, I got plenty of dirt.
There was some environmental effects from that night.
Yes. Yep, for sure.
You had hypnosis to find out actually what happened that night. Did anything come out about after and when you had that late night swim?
I've only had hypnosis, I don't know, maybe somebody asked me that the other day. I think maybe 5 or 6 times, because people don't realize that Bud and I lived 1,500 miles away from each other. You know, he's in New York and I was in Indiana, and neither one of us was rich. And back then, even a phone call was a long distance call that cost a lot of money. And I clearly didn't have any, being a single mom trying to get back on my feet after a divorce. So, you know, we didn't have many opportunities to get together to actually do it. And I can recall at least a few sessions we had, really not a lot came about. I didn't, wasn't a lot I remembered during the actual session. I would remember things afterwards, you know, after I'd come back from New York, Mom and I'd be sitting at the kitchen table, having a cigarette, drinking a cup of coffee, just talking about, you know, what had been going on when I come back from New York, what was going on. And all of a sudden, you know, I'd remember something and I'd say, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot that. And she's like, oh, I remember that. And then we'd start talking about it. So it seemed like it loosened up stuff in my mind to help me remember more. There are a few sessions I do remember recalling some pretty traumatic stuff. It's kind of fuzzy in my head at this point about exactly what happened that night. I do recall having under hypnosis when I recalled seeing that hybrid child. I think that it was after that night when I had the session. I can't remember if it was that night that happened, but I know I remembered it after that night. That was crazy.
And your trip to and fro New York City, so your first time in a big city?
First time in a big city like that, and really first time ever by myself. And I had this weird, and I still kind of do it a little bit. I used to be really afraid of being lost, and I would travel everywhere with a compass. Now, thank God for cell phones. I feel like I can go anywhere in the world now, you know. But so, yeah, that was a big deal for me going to New York. The only other places I'd really been was to Florida with my family. We used to go to Disney World and Indian Rocks Beach for vacation. So, yeah, that was a big deal.
Am I correct in thinking you also had an unusual experience on the coach?
Yes. Oh, yeah. In the book, I think his pseudonym is Lars. Obviously, couldn't get his permission to use his name. Oh, yeah, that was interesting. That was on the way home from my first trip to New York. When I got on that bus, I was absolutely a wreck. I was so confused. I felt worse than I did in some ways than when I got there. And I was more confused than ever because I was ready to write all this stuff off as I'm crazy, you know, and there has to be some other explanation for it. But after I met Bud and started to find out about all the other people and things that people were saying that were so much like mine, you know, that made it harder. And I felt safer in New York. Like I said before, I actually felt safer in New York, and I felt like I was going to go back home to the boonies and be a sitting duck again. And they were going to come back and, you know, maybe they might be mad because I said something to somebody. I don't know. I didn't know. I mean, I was just a confused mess. And the trip there had been kind of traumatic for me because I didn't like traveling. I was uncomfortable around strangers. I think on the way there, the bus trip took 17 hours. And I groan even thinking about it. I remember, like, I practically had my purse wrapped around my neck, clutching onto it, you know, because I was afraid someone would get in my purse if I fell asleep and steal what little money I had. You know, and I just felt weird on the bus. And of course I was having anxiety going there too, but on the way home, I thought to myself, my God, I'm not going to sit next to some smelly, gross person who's going to, you know, pickpocket my purse while I sleep. I'm just going to lay down here and pretend like I'm asleep, so maybe nobody will sit by me. So I did. I flopped my big old butt down on the seat and I laid there like I was asleep. And that worked for the first part of the leg of the journey. And then they made a stop in Philadelphia or in Pennsylvania somewhere, Pittsburgh or Philadelphia. Something starts with a P. Anyways, people got off and more people got on. I was riding all the way to Columbus, so I had a long way to go and I did not have to get off. So I continued to fake sleep, and I could feel people getting on, and I started to peek up over the seat to see how many people were coming in and if I was going to be able to get away with this. And just as I looked up over the seat, that guy walked up the steps and he was looking right at me like he knew exactly where I was, and our eyes locked. And I thought, oh my God. And I ducked my head back down and I thought, oh man, he was so gorgeously beautiful. And I thought, oh, if I have to sit next to anybody, I hope it's him. You know, so I'm laying there and then I feel someone tapping to me and I look up and there's this guy, there's two guys in military uniform. And he's like, can I sit here? I'm like, oh, okay. I figure, well, okay, at least he's in the military. I'm safe. And his buddy sat next to him, kind of kenny-cordered from us. And here comes Mr. Gorgeous. And he sits down for a minute, and he's looking at these two guys, and he's looking at me. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, why is he looking at me? He's so beautiful. And then he says something to the guy in the seat, the other military guy. And I heard him, and he was speaking to the guy also next to me then. He started talking to him, too, and he said, you look very tired. If you'd like, I would be happy to trade seats with you so that both of you could lay down and take a nap. And if the young lady doesn't mind, I'd be happy to sit with her. And I'm like, yes. And they're like, oh, okay. So everybody does the musical chairs, and here I am sitting next to this god of a beautiful person. And I'm thinking, I'm flabbergasted. I can't even think at that point. And he says to me, so where are you going, you know, and where you been? And I told him I had gone to Indiana. I was in New York City. And he goes, what were you doing in New York City? And I said, well, just visiting friends and exploring and doing some little bit of investigating. And he said, oh, and he said, the extraterrestrials will like that or will love that. And I'm like, what? I looked at him and I thought, why did you say that? I didn't say anything about extraterrestrials. And I looked at him kind of weird, and he's like, oh, never mind. And I said, why are you in? And I didn't question it. At that point, I was locked. Where were you at? And he said he was at a place, a friend of his had a child that had some kind of brain injury, and he was at a place where they were researching it or something, and that they could regrow brain cells. And we're going to help this child's brain heal. And I'm like, oh, something along those lines, which went right over my head, totally. And also, I didn't realize that wasn't a thing either. So, I mean, what he said made sense, but I said I have a high school diploma and a beauty school certificate, so quite a bit gets past me, I guess. He asked me all about myself and my kids. At one point, he asked me if I had kids, and I said yes. And he goes, it must be wonderful to have another person live on after you're gone, you know, or something along those lines. And I'm like, yeah. He told me what he did. He told me how old he was. He said he was from, I noticed he had an accent, but it was very subtle. And his voice was very sing-songy, kind of lullaby-ish. It was very lovely. And he said he was from near Sweden. Okay, well, again, that just rolled right over the top of my head, because you aren't near Sweden. It's a country. You're either in it or you're not. And in retrospect, I thought his accent did not sound like any Swedish accent I've ever heard. But, you know, I haven't been very many places either. So all I knew, he was gorgeous. He was tall. And, well, of course, everybody's tall next to me, but he was tall and trim, and he had shoulder-length hair that was blonde and wavy, and he had the most gorgeous robin egg blue eyes I'd ever seen that were like ice, and he had chiseled features. His chin was, you know, his jaw was strong. His skin was perfectly smooth, and the whole 17 hours, I never noticed a shadow of a beard or anything. I never thought about it until a long time later. He never went to the bathroom. I never saw him drink or eat anything that I recall until the bus stop. He was just perfection all the time. At one point, he reached over to me and, you know, like, here's the girl who rode the whole bus trip there with her purse wrapped around her head. And this guy walks, he strolls into my world, and all of a sudden I forget my entire life and I'll follow him anywhere. He puts his hands up to my face and he pulls my hair. I had long blonde hair then. Well, medium length blonde hair. He pulls it up over my ears and he goes, where I'm from, the girls wear their hair like this. And he says, you would look very pretty like that. And I'm like, okay. You know, I wore my hair in bobby pins up over my ears for years after that. But, and then at one point during this whole, I mean, we talked. He pulled out a magazine or a newspaper with writing on it, and he had it spread over our laps at one point, and he was showing me words in his language and then telling me what that they meant, and then had me repeat it, almost like a father teaching his kid, you know, stuff. And at one point, during our conversation, he just out of the blue asked me if he could kiss me. And I said, sure. Again, way out of character for me. I do not do that. I never did that. I probably won't ever do that again. No, but I said, okay. And it was wild. It was amazing and crazy. And whenever it was over, he looked at me like, wow, like it was the most incredible experience he ever had. And I was thinking, wow, it was just so weird. It was just so weird. I mean, I was totally smitten, and I had a fiance. And at that point, if you would have said his name, I would have been who? At one point during the trip, the bus just pulls over. It's in the middle of the night at this point. The bus just pulls over the side of the road out in the middle of nowhere. And then I see the bus driver get out and walk. I can see him in the running lights on the sides of the bus, and he just walks straight out into this open field. And everybody else in the bus was asleep, and me and him were talking and, you know, just, I don't know what we were doing talking. And I said, what's he doing? I was a little disturbed. And he said, oh, he's probably just got to use the restroom. Well, first he said, he's probably just checking the luggage or the tires or something. I go, what? He's not walking around the bus. He walked out in this field. He said, oh, well, maybe he had to use the restroom or something. I'm like, oh, there's a bathroom right here, right behind us, you know, that he could have used. He's like, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. Everything is okay. Don't worry. I'm like, okay. I did what he said. It's like, oh, okay. And then I'm back to my zombie self again. And the bus driver eventually comes back. He wasn't gone that long, but he came back, got in the bus, and off we went. And then we went to this bus stop. He stopped at a bus stop, like a truck stop, bus stop kind of thing. Again, out in the middle of nowhere. And I thought it was a really cool place because it was round and it had all these big, giant round windows, you know, like two stories, and it was all lit up, and it really was cool, pretty. And I'm like, I'm going to go get something to eat. I'm hungry, and go in here and maybe get some coffee. And he's like, okay. And he did not go with me. He stayed in the bus, and I was the only person who got off the bus. And then the bus driver got off, and he went in and he sat down and he got a cup of coffee and he sat down, and I got some food. There was two girls and a guy, an older man in there. And the girls looked like twins. They looked like twin sisters. And nobody spoke to me. They took my money. I got my food, sat down. I started to eat it, and it tasted weird. It tasted like nothing. It tasted like cardboard. And even the stuff that I drank, I think I thought it was orange juice. It didn't taste like orange juice. Close enough, and I was hungry enough that I ate it. Plus, I didn't have much money to waste. And as I sat there and ate my food, everybody just stared at me. Even the bus driver was staring at me while I ate. And I thought, okay, this is a little creepy. Then I got up and I thought, well, I'm going to go to the bathroom, in a real bathroom, and wash my hands and everything before, you know, I get back on the bus. So I go to the bathroom. I open the door, and the mirrors are facing the door. And as I open the door, in the mirror where I should have been seeing myself, I saw this blonde woman, really white blonde hair with this cobalt blue, like turtleneck sweater on. Pretty, very pretty woman, big blue eyes. But I'm like, whoa, you know, because I thought somebody was there. And then I rubbed my eyes and then I looked in the mirror and it was me. And I'm like, oh, well, now I must really be sleepy. So I went to the bathroom and washed my hands. Went back and got back on the bus. As I'm getting on the bus, one guy kind of stumbles around out there a little bit, like he's on drugs or something. And then he gets, I don't know what he was doing, but he got back on the bus. The bus driver got back in and we left. And Lars says, did you have a nice visit? And I said, yeah. He goes, did you get enough to eat? And I go, yeah, I'm fine. You know, just little questions like that. We were up all night long talking. I might have dozed off once or twice, and I would wake up and he'd be like laying on me or have his head on my shoulder, or I'd have my head on his shoulder. It was just so bizarre. Then we got to Columbus, and that was where we were to separate. He was going to get on another bus to Cincinnati, and I was going to get on another bus to Indy. But we had like a layover of about an hour or so before we transfer. So we decided to go to the Burger King, I think is what was in the bus stop. So we're at the Burger King, fixing to get some food. They have a limited menu, so they don't have a lot of stuff on there. But he's like asking me, what is this? What is this sandwich? What is this? You know, and I'm like telling him that's a bacon, egg and cheese croissant. It has bacon, egg and cheese on a croissant. That's a sausage biscuit, you know, explaining everything to him. And he finally looks at the girl and he goes, well, just give me one of each of those sandwiches. That sounds like a lot. It was a limited menu, but it was still a lot of food. Then he wanted a whole bunch of drinks. So we got all our food. And of course, the people behind the counter were looking at him like he was crazy. And I'm like, whatever. He is so cute. He's so beautiful. He can eat whatever he wants. So we sat down and we're eating. And I suddenly have the realization that I'm not going to see this guy anymore after another, you know, half an hour or so. And I start crying almost. I feel panicky, like, oh my God, I can't leave this person. I can't live without him. You know, I'm thinking, he doesn't even know my phone number. I'm never going to see him again. And I thought that. And as soon as I thought that, he looked up at me and he said, don't worry, I'll see you again sometime. I promise you I'll come back. And he says, what's your phone number? So I gave him my phone number and we're eating. He finishes everything and I'm like, I have to go use the restroom. So we're going to the restroom and he starts to follow me into the ladies' room. And I'm like, you can't go in there. He's like, why not? I said, because this is the ladies' room. I said, you see that little skirt? That means me. See those pants legs? That's you. And he's like, oh, okay, I get it. And I thought, what? Do they not have men and women bathrooms in Sweden? What is the deal? So anyway, I went in there and took care of business. And when I came back out, as I opened the door, I practically smack him in the face with this dude is like literally standing at the door waiting for me, which I thought was cute. And we're walking around the bus stop, killing time. He wants me to buy him. He sees a U.S. News and World Report or one of the colorful newspapers in one of the newspaper boxes and asked me to buy one for him. So I did. And I remember we're walking down the hallway, aisleway, and there's windows and there's benches on the other side. And there were a bunch of Amish people sitting there at the bus stop. And when they looked up at him and I swear to God, the looks on their face it struck me weird. It's like, why are they looking at us? Like they were looking at us like we were aliens, for lack of a better word. They were looking at us like we were alien. And then I thought, maybe they're just looking at him because he's so gorgeous and I'm just so, you know, and they're thinking, why is he with her? that's how my brain worked. So, but they looked at us kind of odd, which I couldn't quite figure out. So anyway, it gets time to go. And he says to me, he knows I'm feeling really sad. At this point, I am almost in tears. And he says, I want you to put your headphones on and I want you to turn it on, play the music, listen to the music. And then here, read this, you know, the paper that you got me. Take that and read it. Had it opened up and unfolded. So, and he says again, I promise you, I will come back and get you someday. I'll find you. He said, there's a long silver trailer near where you live and I want to take you there and dance with you. And I'm like, yes. I believed every word of it. So I got on the bus. Now I'm crying and it's pouring down rain. And so the rain feels like me. And we're back out of the bus stop, station terminal, and it's pouring down rain. I turn on the music on my radio headphones and the song begins to play as if it were playing for me. And it was called True by Spandau Ballet. And I listened to the words of it and just got me kind of sideways, the words. It was weird. And then I opened up the newspaper, and I just so happened to open up the whole two-page ad of missing children and all these little kids' faces looking at me. And I just busted out crying. And I got home, and I cried for 2 weeks over this person missing. And I called Bud right away. I called my friend Rosemary in New York, my buddy Mary, and told them all about it. And Rosemary actually told me, she goes, you know, when you first told me about him, I thought, oh, bless her heart. She's so lonely. She really thought I made all that up. And I'm like, no, he's a real person. I'm telling you, he is real. And so Bud helped me do a little self-hypnosis to just relaxing to remember what he had told me on the bus. And I remembered. I remembered where he worked in Cincinnati. I remembered the name. I remembered what he did. I remembered his birthday and how old he was. I remembered a lot of stuff, enough stuff that Bud was able to find him. He found him. He found the place where he was staying, the friend that he was staying with, and he originally talked to the friend first. And the friend told him, oh, yeah, he came home talking about her. You know, he was clearly smitten with her. And he said he was intelligent, but he was very eccentric, and that he was the type of person who would disappear from everybody's life for a year or two at a time, and nobody would know where he was. And then all of a sudden he'd show up one day on your doorstep and he would take off just like it had been yesterday, since he saw you, with no explanation as to where he'd been or what he'd been doing. And that's how he'd always been. And he had come from who knows where and showed up at this guy's doorstep, and the guy was letting him stay there in exchange for letting him work as a motorcycle courier there for a while, because he liked to ice motorcycle race in whatever the country he lived in. I guess apparently he came from enough wealth that he was able to just jet around the world and do whatever he wanted, you know, and disappear wherever he was going. But, Bud did find him. Bud did talk to him. Then I talked to him, and, I had the address where he was at from Bud, and I mailed a coin to him that had two hands clasping. It's bronze coin. And he called me and told me he got the coin, and he would carry it with him forever, and he would never forget me, and he promised he'd come back sometime, and I never saw him again. Every time I heard a motorcycle for like 20 years go down my street, I wonder if that was him. I was such a pathetic old person. But I found out just recently, you know, within the last 5 years, that he actually died less than 2 years after we met, that he died. And I'm certain that it's him. I found the grave site. After trying to find him for years on the internet, when I finally learned how to do the Google and couldn't find anything, I found a grave site in a little town in a little coastal town in Sweden with his full name, all three names, and the exact date of birth that I had for him as his birthday. And he died in 1985, and I think it was 85 or 86, and I met him in like 84 or 85. I mean, so he died right after, who knows for sure what that was about, but I had several dreams about him after that through the years, where he'd come to me in these dreams, and they were vivid, lucid dreams that I always remembered. They were kind of weird, but yeah, so that was my 17-hour bus trip. Yeah, you see, that in and of itself is probably a whole other book I should have probably written, but
it's unusual, isn't it? I mean, is it possible that Lars was, you know, originally from somewhere else, a little bit further away than Sweden?
I don't know. Like I said, he was a real person. Bud confirmed it. Even Rosemary apologized to me after Bud told her, oh yeah, he's real, I talked to him, because they all thought for sure that this poor lonely little old me was just so wretchedly lonely that she just, you know, confabulated this whole thing. And Bud's like, no, I talked to him. And she apologized to me. Both of them apologized to me, because they kind of thought, you know, that it was just crazy. And it was crazy. That is the absolute craziest thing I've ever been through. And the funniest and the craziest part of it was, I didn't realize how crazy it was till afterwards, till I woke up from whatever haze days I was in. All the weirdness seemed normal to me. It didn't bother me. I wasn't afraid. I'd never questioned it ever until a long time later. And I thought, what the hell? I know. That's the craziest part of all to me, because I like to think I had somewhat of a sense, but apparently I didn't.
And again, you know, I mean, I think if we had you sharing everything that's happened to you over the last few years, it would probably be a 15-hour show. So I
That's
would,
right.
So I would suggest to listeners, you know, I mean, it's been 15 years in the making, but you now have a book written, Extraordinary Contact, Life Beyond Intruders.
Yes. It's just come out in the last month or so, and it's available everywhere. All fine online booksellers. You can get it on Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Nobles. It even is in Kindle format now. And hopefully it'll be in Audible soon. It's not yet, but I think we might go there. You can also, you know, you can visit my website at www.debshome.com, and there'll be links there where you can get the book. And I think there's even links there where you can get Intruders and Missing Time, because there have been republished now through August Night Press. So they're also available too, that's a great triple pack there, the three of those books to go together quite well.
I mean, I think I first read Intruders way back in the 90s. It's been a long time. I'm going to have to reread it, in fact. And I'm also going to be reading Extraordinary Contact. That is on my list. But I would suggest visiting Deb's website, and that's debshome.com.
That's correct.
And there's heaps of pictures on there and loads of information. Plus, you can also reach out to Deb, because I know she would love to receive some emails.
Yeah, I really would. I try to answer every email that I get. And I mean, I feel like part of why I wrote the book is because I want to help people. And so, and I don't have a lot of answers. Sometimes I even end up having more questions once I try to figure things of my own out. So, but I'm a good listener, and I want to pay back the support, because I've been so fortunate. I've been blessed to have support. I was blessed to have Bud in my life for 3 years, which so many people reached out to him after Intruders. And I could almost not talk to him on the phone for a year or so, because he was so busy and swamped. And I was lucky enough to have him in my life for the first 3 years there. And so I had the support of my family and neighbors and coworkers and friends, because all these people had weird experiences with me and with, you know, my family. So I feel really blessed, and I want to pay it forward and reach out to others out there like me who aren't so fortunate, so they know they're not alone, and that I want them to feel comfortable telling somebody their story, because their story is important, and I believe them because I've seen some things. So that way they can reach out to me, and like I said, I try to answer everybody's emails personally and as quickly as I can.
Excellent. You did wonderful.
Thank you.
It works really well for me, because I love listening to these accounts, because I get to hear so many wonderful accounts from around the world. So thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it so much.
No problem. Deb, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this for our listeners.
Well, like I said, again, I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm grateful for it. And I've enjoyed myself immensely. I appreciate it.
You enjoy the rest of the evening, okay? And I'll talk to you soon.
Too.
All right.
All righty.
Okay, take care. Take care of yourself.
Yeah, it's you too. Bye-bye.
That is all for today. I hope you enjoyed the extra episode this week. Keep updated and connected with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you've had an encounter you would like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com, or reach out to me via my contact page on my website at ufochroniclespodcast.com. Big thank you to Deb for sharing tonight, and thank you for listening. I will be back on Sunday. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.